I'd like now to welcome to the program Joan Myers. She's a photographer, and she has a new exhibition here in Santa Fe and a new book, both called The Jungle at the Door. The exhibition is at the Andrew Smith Gallery on Grant Street, and there's an opening there from 4 to 6 in the evening on Friday, September 28th. And then right after that, at 6 o'clock, there is a reading and book signing of the book The Jungle at the Door, A Glimpse of Wild India, with Joan and with Bill DeBuise, who wrote the essay in this book. Welcome to the Radio Cafe, Joan.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
So this is a lovely, beautiful book of photographs with an essay by you and with an essay by Bill DeBuise. And basically, you found yourself in India. You, as you describe yourself, as more of a kind of desert person. And how did you find yourself there?
It was actually my husband that really wanted to go to India. It was a time that I didn't really plan to shoot at all. He wanted to go. He wanted to see something of rural India. And I thought, well, why not? This is a part of the world that I had never been to, never seen. I took a camera along really with no intention of doing work for a book or an exhibit. But I found I really loved the jungle in India. It was a very special time to be able to see both sort of contemporary bustling India of Delhi, which is where you fly in, and then to take a little van and end up out in a wildlife refuge with nothing much but jungle and animals.
Nothing much but jungle and animals turns out to be an incredibly rich landscape in which you photographed with the limitations that were imposed on you by basically the guides who were taking you around, that basically tried to make sure that you wouldn't get eaten by predators and things like that.
Yes, you couldn't get out of your Jeep and set up a tripod and go wandering in the forest.
Which you wanted to do.
Of course.
So in the jungles where you were, there's all kinds of animals, some of which are at the edge of extinction. What were some of these animals, and how easy or hard were they to see and photograph?
Well, to answer your second question first, they were difficult to see and difficult to photograph, mainly because they're out early in the morning when the light is low, and they come out for a short time. Tigers come out very early in the morning and do their hunting, and then midday they rest. So you have to basically photograph them under very low light.
Why do they hunt so early in the morning? Do we know?
I don't know why they hunt early in the morning. It's just a cat's time, I think.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
You know, I think leopards are out there in the nighttime only, but the tiger mainly hunts under low light situations. I think it's probably a good time for catching deer, which are their main prey there in the jungle.
And so you went out early in the morning, shivering cold. And is there a process of learning to actually see the creatures that you want to photograph?
You're very perceptive about that. I think that's true because it's hard to pick the animals out from the trees. And they appear for very short periods of time, so you have to be ready to photograph them. This is very different from a National Geographic photographer who has a blind, and they set up and they photograph basically for days at a time.
What's a blind?
A blind is just some sort of a small structure that you build so that you can set up a nice tripod and you can get close to the animal, hopefully.
And they don't see you or smell you.
And they don't see you and they kind of ignore you. And the other way that you can photograph animals in the Indian jungle is on an elephant, because the elephants seem to be just part of the jungle to the tigers and the rhinos.
And so when you're on an elephant, they actually leave you alone.
That's right.
What, do they not notice you?
They don't seem to. At one point, we were on an elephant and actually came up within about 20 feet of a tiger den. There were two tigers. They were actually in the grass. It wasn't like in a hole. And they were just playing together. And that's not something you could have possibly done by walking up to them.
Right. And so tell us about your actual days doing this. I mean, did you stop photographing as soon as the sun really came up?
We did different things. I was with a group of birders. It was a very small group of people, and the birds are out there all day long, so they were very happy all day long. And We mainly started early in the morning, even before dark. It was quite chilly. It was November. And I had on all the clothes that I had brought with me just because I was freezing and shivering and wondering whether I could get my hands to stop shaking to take the pictures. And then by midday, it was warm enough that you could sort of relax. There weren't a lot of large animals out anymore, and it was more of a time to just look around and look at the jungle itself.
What were the large animals besides tigers that were there and that you saw?
We saw the the Indian rhinoceros, which is a one-horned rhino, quite different from the other rhinos. And actually, it's one of the few success stories for endangered animals. They were down to a population of less than 200, I think, in the 20th century, and now they're up to, I think, somewhere around 2,800 of them. It's still quite an endangered situation, but they seem to be doing a little bit better. Unfortunately, they're being poached still for their horns.
Oh, my goodness. The whole issue of poaching, and it happens all over the world, not just in India, but it's terrible in India. What's going on there and why?
Well, I think it's terrible everywhere. There's just a large desire for parts of these animals for medicinal purposes for Chinese medicine. So all the Asian countries will pay a high premium for a rhino horn or a part of a tiger. And other cultures want the tiger skin. So, you know, these poor animals really are struggling not just, I mean, they have the issues of poaching, and then they have the issues of local population, which is close by and hunts. They're not supposed to hunt, of course, in a wildlife refuge, but these are poor people, and they certainly have access to the refuge. And then the animals don't have much habitat left. Their habitat is, I think, 7% was the last thing that I read on tiger habitat at the moment of what it used to be, at the beginning of, say, of the 20th century. So their habitat is considerably reduced. They're, you know, everything is working against them.
And the market for the traditional Chinese medicine is mainly in China. It's not like Santa Feans who are going to get acupuncture or something like that are looking for rhino horns. But there's this huge middle class in China.
That's right. It's not Santa Fe, no. I don't know that anybody here, I hope not, is using rhino or tiger parts. But all over Asia, Vietnam, Laos, Japan, China is the big market, of course. And there's more money to spend there, so
ever growing. It's an intractable problem.
It is, and there are people who are working very hard to try and preserve the habitat for these animals and keep them. But frankly, I think the chances are really slim that, you know, my grandkids will have a chance to see tigers.
The possibility of educating Chinese people or Asian people is also something that people are working on, but that's something that can take a generation or two, and there's not the time for that.
That's right, and there's just so much money now in obtaining a rhino horn. I mean, and when you have very poor people, it's very difficult to prevent that. And there are not enough people in terms of rangers for these parks to really do a good job of protecting them.
We're talking to Joan Myers about her new book, The Jungle at the Door. So, again, let's go back to the actual process of taking these pictures. There's all kinds of little creatures. There's these primates. How do you say them? Hanuman langurs?
Yes, the monkeys.
Monkeys. That's the better word.
That's the sacred monkey for India. And they're everywhere around India. They are not endangered. But, and indeed, people sort of glared at me whenever I wanted to photograph the monkeys because
Why?
They don't like them.
Really?
They're mean. And they throw things, and they're sort of nasty creatures.
But they take your stuff?
They probably would if they had the opportunity, no doubt about it. But, for somebody from this country to see monkeys, they're just sort of lovable, amazing creatures that remind you of human beings.
Right. At least in your picture, they're awfully cute. I think we domesticated urban humans tend to use the C word a lot, cute, but they really are. There are also elephants in the wild. How are they doing?
They're also endangered in the wild, but they do have a large population of domesticated Indian elephants. It's a different creature from the African elephant. It's smaller, has smaller ears, but they still use them all over rural India. I remember one evening coming back, we were in a van, it was just around dusk, and the van screeched to a halt, and I looked out the window, and there was an elephant in the middle of the road lifting a log to help some villagers do something or other. So they're still using them a great deal for work.
Could you get a sense, I can never forget that George Orwell essay about the elephant. Are those elephants that are being used for work, are they being well treated? Do you have any comment on that?
I don't know. I certainly didn't see enough to be able to make a judgment on that. The ones that I saw were treated very well because the mahout, the driver for the elephant, forms a lifetime bond with his elephant.
Right.
And it's a very special relationship, and I think they would do anything to keep their elephant happy.
Now, you also did photograph birds. You were there with a bunch of birders and ended up photographing all sorts of flying birds and water birds and everything. Did you get kind of into birding by being with those folks?
Well, I have nothing against birders. Some of my best friends are birders. But I personally, one racket-tailed drongo was enough for me, and I was happy to look at another bird. And I knew that I wasn't going to remember them the next time that I saw one. So I lack the context to be a good birder. I have to say that the Indian birds, though, were phenomenal, and the birders in the group saw over 300 birds in about 2 weeks out of 350 species available. So there were a lot of birds, and often very beautiful ones. I didn't come prepared to photograph birds. One would normally come with a very long lens and a very professional setup to do that. Since I didn't really plan on doing it at all, I was woefully unprepared for shooting birds.
Now, what was it like? I mean, you do have here, I'm looking at a picture of a Bengal tiger. What was it like to actually see this animal, and how often did you see them?
We only saw them a couple of times. I certainly photographed every time I saw a tiger, and there's probably a photograph in this book from each time that I was able to do that.
So you're quick on the draw.
You have to be quick on the draw. You do get a little warning usually that there's a tiger in the area because the birds make a certain sound, the monkeys make a certain sound. Sometimes you see paw marks on the ground. There's one photograph in here of a paw mark. So you often get a little bit of warning. But the actual sight of a tiger in the wild is really special. It's an awesome encounter because it's a very large creature, I guess about 8 feet long, and they don't look like the tiger in the zoo that looks a little, they usually are sort of relaxed, tired, they pace up and down, they're a little emaciated. But the ones in the wild have much energy. They're just sort of moving smoothly through the grass or the jungle, and you get the feeling of a very powerful creature.
Were they scary?
They're definitely scary. Yeah. They're definitely scary. You get the feeling that you do not want to actually go off on your own through the jungle.
Did any other animals make you feel that way?
No, I don't think so. I was hoping to see a leopard. I never saw a leopard. I think they might make you feel a little bit that way also. The elephants, those are relatively peaceful creatures. The rhinos are very unpredictable and dangerous, but I mainly photograph them, again, on an elephant, and they ignore you. They don't show any desire to charge or act in a violent manner.
I mean, they can do some damage.
They can do serious damage.
Yeah.
They are enormous, and they have those big horns, and they are fast, and they're unpredictable.
Now, you also photographed some human contributions, like shrines and sculptures and art and things like that, always of animals.
Yes, I was really interested in how the jungle was connected to local life, because it's a permeable border. There's not just a little fence and nobody comes in and the animals can't get out. For the most part, there is no fence that keeps creatures in and people out. The people walk through on paths, and the villages are close by the jungle. They're constantly building roads closer and houses closer and fields closer to the jungles, just slowly cutting off little bits and pieces of it. And I was interested early on. Kipling was an influence on me because my father read the Just So stories to me when I was a kid, and that's really about the village and the jungle, how these animals interrelated to. Part of it is just pure jungle, but a lot of it has to do with a village that's close by. And in this case, there were always villages close by.
When you look at issues of habitat and extinction and jungle and human encroachment, it really reminds one that overpopulation of the earth or increasing population of the earth, some people argue with whether or not it's overpopulation, but is a huge and insufficiently talked about problem.
That's right. We don't talk about it very much, and I think at the end of it all, if we're not careful, we're going to be left as the only species out there. I mean, it's not going to be that drastic anytime soon, but certainly these large, beautiful animals from the Indian jungle are very unlikely to survive the next century. I mean, that's sort of what I read into. And I support organizations like Panthera and Save the Tiger, and you know, there's a variety of them that are working really hard to not have that happen. And it would just be an enormous loss. We share the planet with these animals, and it's going to certainly be less of a planet if we don't have them.
And, I mean, ultimately, there's always this question of, I mean, there's the, it will be less of a planet spiritually, or whatever word you use to describe what that is, if and when these animals are gone. But also, eventually, it hurts us.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I mean, physically, we can't survive on a planet which is all cities.
That's right. And the last body of work I did was in Antarctica. And so I got very interested in climate change and global warming issues and looking at the ice. And it's very clear that you change the climate, you change the environment, you do in species. At some point, you're not going to any longer have the same planet.
We're talking to Joan Myers about her book, The Jungle at the Door, A Glimpse of Wild India, which is also an exhibition. And this is a beautiful book, a beautiful production. It's wider than it is tall, and that was to accommodate the shape of the pictures, which are mostly horizontal.
That's right.
And how big are the pictures at the Andrew Smith Gallery? I think they're pretty sizable.
Yes, the smallest ones are about 14 and a half by 22, and then some of them are up about 20 by 30. So they're a little bit bigger, and they give you more of a sense of being able to walk into the jungle and actually see those animals.
Do you use a large format camera?
I shot these all digitally, actually. There was no way that I could shoot large format.
Oh, of course, right.
In fact, they were mainly handheld, which is not something that I usually do. But in this case, there was no other way to do it.
And digital cameras at this point in history give you really good resolution.
They're pretty good. They're pretty good. Yes, in fact, the best of them are certainly of a quality to rival 4x5 or 2.25, which is what I shot so much of in earlier days.
Have you always shot color?
No, I was primarily black and white photographer until I went to the Antarctic.
Uh-huh.
And that was also the time when I started shooting digital. That was now 10 years ago, and it was kind of the beginning of professional quality digital. And it made sense to shoot it there. And actually, I intended to print black and whites back then, and then looked at them, and they were color. So
yeah,
So now I do both.
And
we don't have to choose anymore.
Yeah, it's an amazing time in that respect. Do you, I mean, in the old days of black and white photography, which I guess still exists, I don't know to what extent people are still using it, but a lot of your work was done in the darkroom. What about now?
Do you? Well, now my work is done at the computer, which is in some ways not as much fun. I mean, I actually like the darkroom, but I like the quality of what I can do on the computer and the digital prints that I can make even more than what I could do in the old days in the darkroom. So I think it's a really wonderful and special time for photographers.
So what is next for you? What are you working on now?
I've been shooting volcanic and geothermal sites all over the place, sort of the fire part to go with ice. And that eventually, hopefully, will be a book and an exhibit as well. Also, I'm interested in how these sites relate to human activity. We really live in an uneasy planet. It's not stable under our feet. And so that's what the firework is about.
Bill McKibben, in one of his recent books, added an extra A to the word Earth to kind of symbolize that we're not living on the same Earth that many of us were born onto.
Yes, and you know, he really changed my perceptions of what human beings were doing to the planet. I think more than anybody else, his essay, you know, The End of Nature, was a really important one to me.
Again, the book is called The Jungle at the Door, A Glimpse of Wild India. And the exhibition of that name is happening at the Andrew Smith Gallery on Grant Street this Friday, September 28th, from 4 to 6 in the afternoon. And then right after that, several blocks away at Collected Works Bookstore here in Santa Fe at 6 o'clock, there is a signing and reading of this new book. And Bill DeBlees will be there, who wrote a wonderful essay. He's such a great writer.
He is a phenomenal writer. I feel very lucky to have been able to collaborate with him on this project.
Yeah, it's one of those essays that if the pictures themselves weren't enough, which they are, to make you pick up a copy of the book, the essay is one of those things that I'm going to have to actually go back and read a few times.
It's a very elegant essay about what it is, how it is to see animals, and it's really about seeing overall and seeing landscape and seeing what's going on in that landscape.
Joan Myers, photographer, we will see you on Friday. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you for having me.
And I'd like now to welcome to the program Jeff Halper. He is an Israeli professor of anthropology, and he's coordinator of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions. He will be in Albuquerque this weekend, speaking at the Friends of Sabil conference. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having me on.
So how did you get involved with the whole Israeli-Palestinian conflict so actively?
Well, I'm a child of the 60s in the States. I grew up in Minnesota. I was very active in the civil rights movement, the anti-Vietnam War movement. And then I moved to Israel about 40 years ago for all kinds of reasons we don't have to get into now. And, when I went to Israel, I went with my eyes open. I knew there was an occupation. And, back in those days, we didn't have the word global like they have today. So the word we used in the 60s was the revolution. The revolution will happen wherever. And so in a sense, going to Israel, I was going to another front in the revolution. So I'm committed to living in Israel. I mean, I've lived there all these years. I have a family there. But I'm also committed to ending the occupation and to achieving a just peace with Palestinians, which is crucial for any kind of Israeli existence, even morally, if not only physically.
The very term Israeli-Palestinian conflict suggests a kind of balance where there's not a balance. Describe for our listeners the nature of the power imbalance between these two groups.
Well, that's a very important point, because we're always saying that there is no symmetry here, because people like to talk about both sides. Both sides should negotiate, both sides should end the violence, but there isn't both sides. One country, Israel, is an occupying power over another people, the Palestinians, who are reduced to occupied territories in only 22% of historic Palestine. There's a tremendous power differential. I mean, Israel's a state in the United Nations, a member of the United Nations. The Palestinians have no state. And Israel has an economy three times larger than Palestine, Jordan, Syria, and Lebanon put together. And, of course, Israel has one of the most powerful armies in the world. It's the fourth largest nuclear power and has never signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, does not allow international inspections. It's the fourth largest arms exporter in the world. It exports more arms than China or Britain does. And it's an occupying power. So from that point of view, even though, of course, Palestinians have responsibilities, the lion's share of the burden of resolving this conflict rests with Israel because Israel's in control. And only by giving up control and really by seeking a just peace are we going to get out of this mess that we're in.
How much of Israel's economic base and power is based on U.S. funding?
It's not so much U.S. funding. I mean, first of all, the largest Israeli economy is something, industry is something that no one would ever guess, and it's diamonds.
Really?
A third of the Israeli economy has to do with refining and distributing and cutting of diamonds. And then you have arms exports, and then you have homeland security exports. So that those are very almost recession-proof foundations of an economy. The worse things get, the more people want diamonds and arms and security devices. So it isn't so much, I mean, there is a very important American component. You know, the United States gives Israel close to $4 billion a year in military aid. But more important is the access, the privileged access that the United States gives Israel to its military technology. That's what gives Israel the competitive edge in the market, and that's why Israel can develop all kinds of very sophisticated high-tech weapons, both weapons for the military and weapons for police and homeland security, that make it a very powerful military force. So what Israel contributes is its high-tech expertise and its experience with the Palestinians. If you look at the occupied territories as a laboratory, Israel takes what it learns from controlling and suppressing and pacifying the Palestinians for the last 45 years, and that's one of its major exports. And that ties in then with the American military, military-industrial complex, you know, with the military developments in the United States, because the United States has got to make the turn from interstate warfare, like warfare with the Soviet Union, to what's called counterinsurgency, asymmetrical warfare, and low-intensity warfare, and so on. And Israel's the expert at that. So it's the combination of Israeli expertise and experience with American, not just funding, but like I say, access to American military technology that makes Israel so powerful.
So the United States is actually taking knowledge that Israel is teaching them on how to keep, for example, a people in one area or expelling people from one area to another or whatever, and using that ourselves toward other people?
Of course. First of all, the drones, the famous drones, the UAVs, the unmanned aerial aircraft that are used in Afghanistan, for example, and now that are being imported by American police forces, are mainly Israeli technology. There's an American drone, but it's the drone technology. Israel's the world's leader in drone technology, and also the high-tech surveillance and even targeting, even the military parts of drones. The United States, Israel trains American police forces. I'm sure the Santa Fe Police Department, if anybody would ask, has undergone training in Israel by the Israeli police. Israel, it's well known, has taken over a lot of the security at American airports. I mean, LAX is almost run by Israeli kind of homeland security stuff. And, of course, in terms of counterinsurgency, helping the United States in Kurdistan that isn't very well known, certainly in Afghanistan, in all the covert warfare things. Israel's very active. So the United States, yeah, I mean, it's not that the United States can't develop technology. But, you know, the Pentagon is like this huge oil tanker. You know, it's committed to F-35s, the next generation of fighter aircraft that nobody needs, and nuclear submarines, and a huge military, whereas Israel is this little tugboat that's trying to turn this oil tanker in terms of high-tech but sort of lower-force counterinsurgency. You know, today the new paradigm of warfare that the military talk about is warfare amongst the people. You know, resource wars. The famous American bumper sticker that everybody's seen, how did our oil get under their sand? And right. In all of that kind of warfare amongst the people, Israel, with its experience with the Palestinians, is absolutely the leading force and is able to help the United States to make that turn into this new kind of warfare.
So that explains a lot about the alliance between the United States and Israel. I mean, it's not just about getting votes in Florida.
Exactly. And that's the point. You know, Kissinger, our friend Kissinger, used to say that countries don't have friends. They have interests. And I've been trying to ask myself, why does the United States have this commitment to Israel? Because it's counterproductive to American interests. It alienates the entire Muslim world. You know, the occupation is seen not as an Israeli occupation, but as an American-Israeli occupation. It's clear Israel couldn't maintain its control of the Palestinians for a month without American military, political, and financial support, which alienates it from a very strategic Muslim world stretching from Nigeria to Indonesia. And the question is, why? Why would the United States do that? And the only real big reason I can come to, you know, they talk about Israel's helps in the fight against terrorism. Well, in fact, Israel inflames terrorism, especially against the United States. They talk about, you know, common moral values and we're both democracies and all that, but that countries don't run their foreign policies on that. The big elephant in the room that we're not talking about, that we should be, is the military cooperation. As the United States is really beginning to be the power in the world that in a sense, I'll put it in a kind of a radicalish way, is the power pushing this very aggressive neoliberal capitalism that in a world of scarce resources has got to get into wars with third world countries all over the world. And as you get into the 99%, 1% equation back home, it has to be prepared to control working class people, minorities, immigrants, dissidents, and others that will find nothing, no future in that kind of a society. And from that point of view, I think Israel provides that. It provides the military outreach in terms of counterinsurgency tactics and weaponry. And it also provides tactics and weaponry that it's learned on Palestinians in Gaza and Jenin and other places to train American police forces. So what I try to tell American audiences is don't think that this technology ends in Gaza and the Palestinians are suffering. It comes right into Santa Fe, right through your police department, and it's there. You simply, you know, aren't aware of it yet.
Right. We're talking to professor and activist Jeff Halper. So let's talk about land for a moment. You have a situation where Palestinians represent approximately 50% of the population of this region, Israel and the occupied territories, and they're living on an ever-shrinking amount of land, a tiny fraction of the total land at this point. What does Israel, I mean, they're not stupid. They've got a plan. What do they think is going to happen if they take away all their land? Where do they think these people are going to go?
Well, wherever they go is fine, just so they go, first of all.
Do they think they're really going to go?
Well, the middle classes are going. The middle class, the Palestinian middle classes, you know, if you're a middle class family and you think there's no future for your children, there's no education, there's no jobs, you can't get housing, Israel's demolished 27,000 homes since 1967. you know, your kids won't even be able to have a home, you leave. And it's true, the poorer people, the masses can't leave. And they're confined to what we call areas A and B of the West Bank, little islands on about 15% of the West Bank, little islands, ghettos, really, in East Jerusalem and Gaza. So that I think Israel's idea is it's beyond apartheid. Apartheid, somehow you get a collaborator, like in South Africa, to agree to a Palestinian Bantustan. You're not going to get a Palestinian leader to agree to that. And so really where Israel's is going is towards what we call warehousing. Like in a prison, you know, the concept warehousing comes out of the American prison system where you get inmates locked away, they're out of sight, out of mind, and that's it. So Israel has pacified the Palestinians who are living in more than 70 little islands behind a huge wall, twice as high as the Berlin Wall. And now that they've been pacified and quietized, there's no more violence, there's no more terrorism, you don't hear from Palestinians. Now the idea is to shift attention to other things, like Iran, for example. So when last time Netanyahu met with President Obama, he came back to Israel and he was asked, you know, what was the essence of your meeting? And he said the key was that this is the first time an Israeli prime minister has met an American president, and the Palestinian issue wasn't even raised. You see, we've talked about Iran, and then, of course, you can talk about terrorism. So that's the idea, to warehouse the Palestinians, to shut them away in these little cells, throw away the key, let the UN feed them, completely get them off the front pages of the newspaper, and then turn the world's attention to other things. So in a sense, this is really a test for human rights and international law, you know, because if Israel succeeds, it sends a pretty chilling message to the rest of the world in which, in fact, the capitalist powers would like to do the same thing. They'd like to take their resources and lock them up. You know, two-thirds of humanity, I think, is seen by corporations as surplus humanity. There's nothing to do with them except feed them and warehouse them somewhere. I think the whole continent of Africa is like that. So I think the Israeli experiment with warehousing has its global dimensions. I talk about a global Palestine. But that's the idea, that we can get away, we can warehouse them, shut them up, make them disappear, and the world will go on to other agendas.
But the world isn't going on to other agendas, is it? I mean, you tell us, how is the world responding? The Arab world, Europe, the United States, everybody?
Well, you know, I think it's true, and this is what we've been working on all these years, is to get the Palestinian issue, what I would like to see, and I think we've succeeded, is to get it to the dimensions of the anti-apartheid struggle. And I think all over the world, the Palestinian issue is one of the key issues that people talk about. Churches are now speaking out on divestment and moral, you know, BDS, boycotts, divestment, sanctions. You've got TIAA Cref, one of the largest investment insurance companies in the world, that just divested from Caterpillar. I mean, you've got some movement. The problem is that governments are not leading. And governments are going to be the last actor that falls into place. So what we have to do is build a fire under them. It's much easier in Europe and obviously in other parts of the world than it is in the United States. And that's our big problem. As long as Israel has bipartisan support of Congress, it doesn't even care about the president and the administration. Israel feels it's immune from any sanctions and from anything. So let the world moan and cry and whimper and whatever. As long as Congress is in Israel's corner, we're fine. And that's why we're, you know, I think the Albuquerque Sabeel Conference is important. All this work to get to the American public, and especially through churches and through unions and through university groups and so on, to try to get them to understand especially how this is really compromising the American position of the world. in addition to the human rights of Palestinians, all this is something that has to be done in order to somehow shift American government policies. But right now, and I don't think Americans are aware of it, right now this conflict is tremendously isolating the United States and the world. You know, when you have a Security Council vote like it was last year on settlements, 14-1 against the United States, in which even Germany, with its history, is voting against the Israeli settlements, and the United States is standing isolated against human rights, I think that isolates the United States in the world to a degree that the American people don't really appreciate. And so it's true. Until we somehow can get the American people or pressure under, to move Congress somehow, it's going to be very hard to get anywhere with this conflict.
We're talking to activist and professor Jeff Halper. The way you frame it, it really starts to sound like democracy versus the military-industrial complex rather than Israel versus Palestine.
That's right. No, for sure. I mean, there's been a lot of work done on what's called transnational capitalism. And in a transnational capital class of the elites. I mean, you know, we're all American, 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 or you're all American, you know, and all this kind of stuff. But the elites in the United States are transnational. They have their country clubs in Switzerland. They have their private clubs in all over the world. They have their interlocking boards of directors all over, so that corporations are loyal to profit. And it's very hard today to have a profit without oppressing the peoples of what's called the periphery of the
right.
global system,
exactly.
The poor people of the world. And that's where, that's true. The military-industrial complex, as Eisenhower called it, has its transnational aspects to it.
Very, very interesting. Now, you are Jewish, you are Israeli, you go around the world talking to everybody, including Jewish communities. How do people respond to what you're saying and to your work?
I think if I get a platform, I think they begin to respond because I can lay out an alternative logic and, you know, it makes sense. The problem is, especially for the Jewish community, I have to say, that I don't have the access. I mean, I can't get into synagogues. I can't get into the federations. Look at how the Albuquerque Jewish Federation is fighting the Sabeel Conference. And American Jews, you know, we call them PEPs. PEP means Progressive Except Palestine.
Right.
American Jews are the most liberal of all American groups. But when you hit the Israel-Palestine issue, they become reaction. I mean, they're in coalition with John Hagee and the Christian fundamentalists and people they would never talk to in 100 years on other issues.
Why is that?
I don't know why that is exactly. I think, first of all, I don't know if it's actually true, because 70% of American Jews are not affiliated with anything in the Jewish community. You know, they're Seinfeld. They're not in a synagogue. They're not in a federation. Not in B'nai B'rith or Hadassah. They're simply Americans that happen to be Jews. And I think probably most of them share the same criticisms of Israel that other people have. What the voice you hear is the 30% of what's called the organized Jewish community, the federations and Hillel, that have taken upon themselves to be somehow pro-Israel advocates. And, I don't think their voice is representative of the American Jewish community, but most American Jews are in the woodwork, so it's hard to – they're not speaking out in an alternative voice. But I would submit that the voice of AIPAC and the voice of these organized Jewish groups are extreme voices at the service of a foreign government. That's something that people, that's a weird kind of a thing, how Israel has somehow become a domestic issue. You know, there's an organization called Friends of the IDF, of the Israel Defense Forces, of the Israel Army, that are a charity, a tax-exempt charity of the United
right.
States.
Yeah, yeah.
And you can give to a foreign army, the Israeli army, and get a tax exemption. That's a weird situation that it's hard to explain how that came about.
Is there a generation gap? Are younger people just as anti-Palestinian as their parents and grandparents?
Well, the research indicates no. That, in fact, young American Jews have kind of turned off on Israel. And that's why I think, in kind of in desperation, this birthright program has been born, where every young Jewish kid from the age, I think, of 17 to 23 can get a fully paid 2-week brainwashing tour of Israel. So you have the pro-Israel lobbyists on campus and so on, but I think they're isolated. I think more and more American young people are beginning to think in terms of human rights. I think that's starting to gain ground in the United States. And it's very hard to defend Israeli policies. I mean, it has nothing to do with terrorism or Israel. You know, the Israeli occupation is something that can't be hidden. And I think American Jewish kids are on to that. So that doesn't mean that they're necessarily joining with the Palestinians, but I don't think they're the pro-Israel activists that their parents might have been.
What is the Sabeel conference all about?
Well, Sabeel, we've worked with Sabeel for years. It's a Palestinian Christian liberation theology organization. Sabeel provides a very important moral voice in Christian terms about the conflict, and are trying very hard to get churches to respond to the moral issues, and even presenting human rights as a form of a moral issue in a way that they're hesitant to do. So I think this is my 40th Sabeel conference in the United States. You know, and they're held in churches or college campuses, very good speakers, Palestinians, a lot of Jews, American Jews, Israeli Jews participate, plus a lot of other people. There's talks, and then there's also workshops. So Sabeel is a wonderful way of getting exposed to a critical voice on Israel-Palestine, especially through hearing Israelis, Israeli Jews, and Palestinians.
The Sabeel Conference is happening this weekend, the 28th and 29th of September in Albuquerque. And for more information, people can go to fosna.org, FOSNA.org. And you will be speaking there, and a number of other terrific speakers are going to be in Albuquerque this weekend.
No, that's right. There's really, I mean, it's the top line of speakers on this topic. And so I think what's really good about Sabeel is it's not simply haranguing. It really is intellectual. I mean, it has a religious element. I'm not religious at all. So that's one element, trying to get the churches. But on the other hand, trying to bring out a critical voice of human rights and peace. One of the messages being, by all of us being together, is that we refuse to be enemies.
Yeah.
Israelis and Palestinians refuse to be enemies, and you, governments or organizations, whoever you are, that are trying to make us enemies, will not succeed.
Jeff Halper is an Israeli professor of anthropology, and he's coordinator of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Okay, thanks for having me on.